Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and this is Yoga Birth Babies. And I am absolutely thrilled and excited to be speaking with Dr. Sarah Buckley. So some of you guys may not know who she is, so let me give you a little bit of her background. Dr. Sarah Buckley is a family physician with training in family physician obstetrics and author of the internationally best-selling book, Gentle Birth, Gentle Mothering. Sarah is also the mother of four children, all naturally born and naturally raised, now in their teen years and beyond. Sarah currently combines mothering with her work as a writer and lecturer on pregnancy, birth, and parenting. Sarah has a special interest in hormonal physiology and is the author of the scientific report, Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing, published in January 2015 by Childbirth Connections, now a program of the National Partnership for Women and Families, with support from Donna International and Lamaze International. This report has been described as one of the most revolutionary and influential publications on maternity and newborn care ever issued. Sarah is committed to the best possible outcomes for mothers, babies, fathers, and families in the relationship to hormonal physiology in childbearing, and is currently also pursuing a PhD at the University of Queensland on this topic. Wow, that's quite a resume that you have, Naman.
Thanks, Dave.
So super excited to talk to you. I'm just going to jump in unless you had anything you wanted me to say before we started some questions.
No, it's all good. I'm here in Brisbane in sunny Queensland in Australia. It's the middle of winter, but you may hear my dog bark. So if you hear a dog, that's Marla.
That's okay. You may hear my baby cry. So we're good. Pretty even on that. So Sarah, about a year and a half, I was really fortunate to attend this day-long wonderful class on undisturbed birth. And it really helped me redefine and edit the way I speak with women about the need for privacy and protection during birth. So that idea of undisturbed birth can be new for many people, and it's extremely important. So would you mind describing it?
Yes. Well, the first thing to realize, Deb, is that we're actually mammals. We're mammals because we have mammary glands, we suckle our young, but our reproductive system, and particularly the episode of labor and birth, or parturition as it's scientifically called, has developed from our mammalian ancestors, which we think is about 65 million years ago, the first placental mammals. So over those 65 million years, human birth has evolved in the context of the wild. So we gave birth out there where, you know, elephants and dogs and wolves and things are still giving birth. So our whole system of childbearing is really oriented to successful birth in the wild. And in the wild, it's so critical that the laboring female knows she's in a safe place to give birth, because for listeners who've had a baby already, you'll know that, you know, defending yourself against a predator is not an easy thing in labor. You can't do fight or flight very easily. But also the laboring female is very vulnerable because she's behaving strangely. There's these strange noises, strange smells, the blood, the amniotic fluid, the tasty little morsel, as I describe it, that comes out at the end that any predator would love to gobble up. So that the hormonal physiology, the way that our hormones are designed to work in human labor and birth, has evolved over these millions of years. And the critical thing for all mammals, for the laboring female, is that she feels private, safe, and unobserved. And I talk about that in quite a lot of detail in my workshops, and we tell some animal birth stories. But basically, the laboring female is in this extraordinarily quite exceptional state of mind where she's very, you know, kind of on another planet, and there's hormonal reasons for that, beta endorphins, oxytocin as well. So, you know, if you're with the woman in natural labor, or you've been through that yourself, what we call physiologic labor and birth, where it's your own natural body processes, you do enter this kind of altered state. You know, it's a bit like a runner's high, the high levels of beta endorphins, and you become a little detached from your surroundings. And what I say is that helps us to transcend the stress and pain of labor. But at the same time, we also have high levels of the fight or flight hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline, just high enough to keep us alert. So you're kind of alert. And again, if you've been in labor, you'll recognize this, like you are in this kind of dreamy state. But also if someone mentions anything about your safety or your baby's safety, even in the next room, you can pick it up because you've got these sharp senses. So I call feeling private, safe and unobserved the core requirements for birth among all mammals. And that doesn't mean we've got to go and give birth in a cave. You know, some mammals are solitary birthers, but other mammals give birth in social groups like elephants, like mice, like dolphins have a female helper with them. So it really how the laboring female feels safe. That's a really critical thing, is to set up a situation for yourself where you can feel as safe as possible. And another way of thinking about labor and birth, I don't know if I meant this in the workshop, Deb, but you know, these hormones we're talking about, hormonal physiology of childbearing, are almost identical to the hormones involved in making a baby. Now we've got oxytocin, hormone of love. We've got beta endorphins, hormones of pleasure and reward, and they're those ones that put you into that altered state of consciousness. We've got adrenaline and noradrenaline that peak at that moment of birth or the moment of orgasm, which are actually very similar hormonally. And then we've got prolactin, the hormone of breastfeeding and tender mothering, which is also a stress-reducing hormone, and that's also released both having a baby and making a baby. So the kind of conditions that we need to have a baby are actually very similar to the conditions we need to make a baby. So that's quite a good rule of thumb if you're planning a birth or if you're a birth attendant. You know, is this a situation in which, you know, the woman would be comfortable, would be able to successfully make a baby? You know, that means that it's a good condition for her to have a baby, that she will feel private, safe and unobserved, that her levels of stress hormones, particularly the flight or fight hormones, will be low enough for the hormonal physiology to flow.
It's so funny that you're talking about, because I believe that the you can't make a baby in bright settings and people disturbing you. And I just recently caught on to this YouTube video. I don't know if you've heard it or seen it. It's called Sex Like Birth. And it shows basically what if conception sex was managed like a hospital birth. They have people coming in and out and putting monitors on and turning the lights on and asking questions during the whole thing. So I would say go to YouTube and check that out. I think you'd relate to that quite a bit.
Yes, I've seen that one. And, you know, the other great thing about that is it really highlights that the people coming in or the people caring for us in the situation that we're in currently in maternity care are usually strangers as well. It's not just that there's lots of people there, because, you know, some women do want lots of people around them when they give birth, but no one would volunteer to have lots of strangers around them. And that's particularly upsetting to our like primal alertness systems. We could say the limbic system, the primitive part of the brain, goes on red alert when we have strangers there.
So you're basically talking, we kind of break it down to the hormones. You know, if the adrenaline increases, it's going to deplete the functionality of oxytocin. So we really need to try to make moms feel, as you keep saying, like safe and undisturbed. So what are some ways that we can help the mom honor the physiological response in her body when in labor, especially if she's in a hospital setting or feeling pressure to stay within like a certain schedule from her care provider or hospital?
Yeah, so the first thing, you know, going right back to the beginning of pregnancy or even before, is choosing your model of care, because we know that some maternity caregivers are associated with high rates of physiologic birth and some with low rates. So if you really want to aim for a physiologic, natural, gentle, however you want to describe it, birth, you know, you really need to choose a care provider that's expert in that. And the expert in that is generally the midwife. So choosing a midwife as your primary carer, wherever you are in the world, but including in the US, is a good start. You know, we know that there's multiple studies, including randomized controlled trials, women are randomly allocated to midwifery care or standard care, that show better outcomes, that show lower rates of interventions, that show high rates of satisfaction, and interestingly, actually, lower rates of fetal loss after 24 weeks, which is really interesting hormonally to me as well. So model of care is really important. Again, you know, using those criteria when you go and visit that place where you're planning to give birth, is this somewhere where I could make a baby? Can I arrange a situation for myself where I feel private, safe and unobserved there? Especially if it's your first baby, because, you know, those systems have never worked themselves out before. You've never experienced this whole hormonal physiology, and it takes a bit longer to kick in. again, you know, you really need to feel even more private and safe with your first baby. And it's kind of why often first-time mums end up giving birth in the smallest room in the house, which might be the bathroom, the toilet, the shower, yeah, where they feel really, really safe. So, you know, place of birth is really important as well. And if a midwife or midwifery care is not available to you, or if you're in a high-risk category where you do need, you know, obstetrician, OB care, then having a doula with you. And again, there's really good evidence that having a doula, a supportive birth companion with you, reduces the need for interventions, increases satisfaction with birth as well. So those are really great kind of structures to set up for yourself. And the other way to answer that question, you may remember this part of the workshop, Deb, where we did some workshopping ourselves, and we looked at, you know, people got in groups and talked about how can they apply these principles of undisturbed birth in their own working environment. And there's been some great suggestions over the years that I've been running these workshops, and these are from midwives and labouring women themselves. And, you know, one of the primal systems of our brain that's very connected to this limbic system, the middle layer, the kind of more primitive part of the brain, is a sense of smell. So, you know, when we go into those strange places and there's all these strange smells, that actually activates the alertness system as well. So, you know, taking something that smells familiar, some women use aromatherapy, but, you know, one that I really like is, you know, take your own pillow, and, you know, you can stuff your head into your pillow, and that, you know, that means you're not seeing strange things, you're not interacting with people, you kind of create your own zone, and you're also having familiar smells around you. So there's a whole lot of suggestions like that, but it's really, you know, how thinking for yourself, what is going to make me feel private and safe and unobserved at that really primal level? It's not intellectually I'm safe going to hospital, it's really, you know, what does my body need to feel private and safe and unobserved here?
And then also the idea that we need to remove some of the fear around the birth. What do you think about that? Because that's going to increase the adrenaline. So I guess, of course, the private's safe. How do you suggest a woman acknowledges or works with some fear that might come up?
So, yeah, so some, you know, some fear is normal in labor and birth. I mean, it is, particularly with your first baby or even with subsequent babies, it's an unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. We're going through this passage, this doorway, and we don't know for sure what's on the other side. We don't know how we'll cope with that passage. So, you know, some anticipatory fear is quite normal. But it's really having care providers that can work with that, you know, that aren't going to kind of medicate your fear, that are going to be able to work with you and appreciate that this is just a normal process. And there is a point in labor as well where you could experience what's been called physiological fear, like towards the end of labor, you know, that you can get a surge of this adrenaline and noradrenaline in a physiologic labor. They're also called epinephrine, norepinephrine. And just those hormones can make you feel fearful. And it's that part of labor where you go, oh my God, I can't do it. Take me home, cut it out of me, take me to hospital, you know. And it's called transition because you're in transition from one hormonal state to another. So to be with care providers who can actually hold the space for that and not freak out themselves, or not be trying to stop your fear, but to encourage you to work with your fear. That's really, really important. So I think, for personally, I think care providers are the answer to that, but also the continuity, so that by the time you get into labor and birth, you have a solid relationship with your care providers. And again, it's not something you get a lot in a standard maternity care system. Even if you've got your own OB, you're not going to see them that much. You're probably not going to discuss your personal emotional reaction to pregnancy. So again, your own midwife or doula is someone that's much more likely to be open to those discussions with you, and particularly if you do have some specific fears, you know, that you've we certainly can imbibe a lot of fears from our culture. If you've had previous bad experiences, have friends with bad experiences, those are really important to talk about through the pregnancy. And, you know, studies have shown even for women with, you know, really massive, you could say, you know, medically diagnosed fear of labor called tocophobia, those kind of interventions of having the ability to talk it through with a supportive counselor in pregnancy really does increase their chance of having a normal physiological birth.
Yeah, everyone I talk to, and I've been doing this for 15 years, it just keeps coming back to the care provider. And the part I run into, the obstacle with a lot of my students, is the idea of a midwife seems so foreign, even in this day where we're always talking about midwives, and they just keep staying, many of them stick with their original OB, and then they get well into labor, into pregnancy, start to learn more, and then around 36 weeks realize maybe they didn't match themselves up with the right person that shares the same philosophy. So would you say at that point, you know, just get a really good doula and let them be as educated as they can to make choices?
Oh, look, you've got to make the decision that's right for you at the time, and there's going to be all kind of circumstances involved there. But yes, definitely, it's never too late to set yourself up with an ideal situation. And, you know, the other thing that I recommend, you know, if you talk about where do you feel private, safe and unobserved, well, for most of us, it's actually going to be at home. So, you know, the longer you can stay at home, you know, the more of a chance, especially with your first baby, you've got for those hormones to kick in. And, you know, I describe, and this is true hormonally, that labor is like a snowball. It starts off small and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and in the end it's unstoppable. And that's true hormonally at the beginning of labor. You know, anything that disturbs labor will shut it down. As you say, it'll increase your adrenaline, noradrenaline, it'll reduce your contractions. It's basically giving you that space for fight or flight that you'd need if a predator was around. It's that kind of response in your body. However, at the end of labor, it's a different response. And again, if you think about, you know, giving birth in the wild, you know, and a saber-toothed tiger turns up at the beginning of labor, obviously, you know, it's safer for the mother and baby to stay, but stop and the mother can run away. But if it occurs at the end of labor, when labor is this huge snowball that's virtually unstoppable, it makes more sense to, you know, trigger a quick and easy birth. The mother scoops up the baby and then runs away. So that's actually the reaction to stress at the end of labor. It's been called the fetus ejection reflex. So particularly if it's your first baby, but even with subsequent babies, the longer you can stay home to have all those systems going until the snowball gets, you could say, big enough that it won't be disrupted by moving to hospital. And again, from one of my workshops, one of the midwives says, I know it's time for a woman to go to labor when she can't remember her phone number. So that's really a sign that she's deeply in that hormonal state. And it's a sign that, you know, she's had enough of these, you know, actually scientifically or physiologically, it's actually hormonal feedback systems, positive feedback systems that accelerate labor and birth. Like, for example, oxytocin actually has a positive feedback cycle with itself on the brain. So the more oxytocin is released, the more that gets released, which is why it's like a snowball effect. And then you get to the stage where it's virtually unstoppable, and then you can move to hospital and it's not going to railroad your labor. And it's possible you may have your baby on the way there, or just as you walk in the door, or within the first half an hour. That's highly likely, but you're not going to get, you know, the disruption of your labor and birth. You're not going to, you're much less likely to need interventions, and you're much more likely to have a physiologic birth. But again, you know, probably especially with your first baby, you know, you probably want someone at home to support you, or you want someone you can ring up. You know, again, having a low technology model of care that's going to support you to do that is going to be really helpful for you when it comes to that stage of labor. And, you know, I also want to just highlight your point that, you know, especially as a first-time pregnant mum, you know, you go with the flow, and, you know, of course you think that your care provider is there with your interests at heart, and they're probably going to say the right thing in the beginning. And then often as pregnancy goes on, they, you know, people start to say things to you like, oh, your baby's getting a bit big, and I wouldn't want you to go overdue. And, you know, and then it becomes obvious towards the end that that your care provider has a particular agenda that doesn't necessarily coincide with your agenda. So, you know, I really suggest having a good, hard think about it. The earlier, the better. You know, you don't want to get to 36 weeks and have to change care provider if possible. So, you know, my rule of thumb here is, you know, interview some care providers, go and see a midwife and see what she can offer you, and especially, you know, monitor yourself. Like, how do I feel at the end of that consultation? Do I feel happier? Do I feel more confident? Because that's actually, from my perspective, the role of the care provider in pregnancy is to make you more happy, more confident, more connected to your baby than you were before the consultation.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Well, that's perfect, because if someone realizes maybe, wow, I'm not with who I thought would be my biggest cheerleader, you're saying stay at home as long as possible, get the snowball going, ideally have a doula. That's my little bias. I am a doula. So, you know, someone that can read the signposts of labor and then come in when things are unstoppable. Because if they show up too early and they're not on board with their care provider, things can start to get into kind of that cascade of intervention. So I love
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And when they look, you know, for example, cesareans done in labor, you know, the bulk of those cesareans are actually done before the woman even gets into active labor. So coming into the hospital too soon means you're going to get kind of the clock's going to start ticking and you're going to have timelines and hours put on you. And then the other thing that can happen, of course, is, you know, people want to speed up your labor so they break your waters, you know, and that sets the clock ticking because then the baby doesn't have that protection and then you have so many hours to have the baby and then you're under pressure, not just physiologically, but you're also under pressure for the cesarean. And again, it can be a, you know, a snowball, you know, it can be a cascade of intervention where, you know, just from coming into hospital early, you end up with a cesarean that wouldn't have been necessary if you had that support to stay at home and really go through the early part of labor and get into that really active labor, as it's called.
Yeah, so if she comes in too early and she's on the clock and they're starting intervention and she's getting more and more anxious, well, then if she's not even in active labor and the anxiety and stress is lifting, I guess that's going to lift the adrenaline. And so it's going to be really hard for the oxytocin to flow. So she's really hitting a wall because she's kind of between her wall and a hard place. So that kind of shifts me a little bit. I want to start to ask a little about Pitocin. Can you explain what happens to the hormonal balance once Pitocin is introduced? Because then if I'm understanding it, the body's natural production of oxytocin and endorphins gets interrupted, or am I wrong with that?
Okay, well, let's just go back a step. So yeah. Pitocin is a synthetic form of the natural hormone oxytocin that we release. We actually release it under a lot of circumstances. If you want to know all the oxytocin information, I'm going to refer you to my report, Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing. So it's interesting. There's been so much research on oxytocin outside of reproduction. It's called the hormone of trust, the hormone of monogamy, the cuddle hormone, the love hormone. As you can gather, it has lots of positive effects by its effects within the brain. It's released within the brain. It counteracts the stress system. It makes us warm, connected, calm, switches on the relaxation and growth, switches off the stress system. So by fortunate circumstance, our evolutionary and Mother Nature's superb design, as I call it, we release this during labor and birth, when it not only causes the rhythmic contractions of labor, but it has all those same effects in the brain. So it has a natural pain-relieving effect. It makes us calm and connected, and it's also switching on the brain centers to bond with our baby so that we get that euphoria, that ecstasy, as I describe it, after the birth when we meet our baby for the first time. So that's its kind of natural function. Now, the problem with synthetic oxytocin, although it's exactly the same molecule, it's synthesized. If you look at the, you know, the chemical structure of it, it looks exactly the same. It works differently in the body because it's not released from the brain. Yeah, when it's released from the brain into the body, it has brain and body effects. When it's injected into the body, it only has physical effects on the body because it can't cross into the brain, called the blood-brain barrier. Yeah, so it has these physical effects of causing these stronger contractions of labor. And you know, if it's given early in labor, the mother hasn't had a chance to build up her own pain relief mechanisms, which is oxytocin and beta endorphins, both help her to deal with the stress pain of labor. So she hasn't had a chance to build those up. She's getting these contractions that are longer, stronger, and closer together than her body naturally produce at that time of labor. And then, you know, and labor is more painful for her. And she's not getting those central effects. Now, does giving natural synthetic oxytocin interfere with the woman's natural oxytocin release? Well, we can't actually answer that question because when we measure it in the bloodstream, we can't differentiate between her own oxytocin and the synthetic version. So we can't answer that question categorically. But in general, as I described before, labor is a positive feedback system, you know, and oxytocin has positive feedbacks on itself. So it doesn't, as far as from those physiologic understandings, we wouldn't expect that during labor that giving synthetic oxytocin would stop the mother's own oxytocin. And in fact, if it causes stronger contractions, there's a part of this positive feedback loop that I'm talking about, those the sensations of the contractions actually feed back to the brain by a special nerve route. And within the brain, they increase the output of oxytocin. So that's how we get this feedback loop of stronger contractions, because stronger contractions signal to the brain releases oxytocin, more pain relief effects within the brain, but also more released from the brain, so more strong contraction. So that's a positive feedback loop. So if synthetic oxytocin or really anything, you know, prostaglandins, any chemical, any, you know, mechanical thing causes increased contractions, it probably is going to increase the oxytocin within the brain to some extent, but not as much as if it's released from the brain. And the reason I say that is from a practical perspective, when we give synthetic oxytocin, it doesn't have those pain relieving effects. Labor is more painful, and generally women need artificial pain relief, which is really a sign that their own hormonal physiology has been disrupted. But there's one other thing to say about, which is a little complex, so just bear with me. So a hormone is technically, it's a substance that's released from one part of the body that has effects on another part of the body. And the way that has effects is it binds to a specific receptor. And it's a bit like putting a specific key into a specific lock. The receptor's on the outside of the cell wall. It turns the key in the lock, sends a message inside the cell what to do. So oxytocin is released from the brain, travels to the woman's uterus, finds the oxytocin receptors on the outside of her uterine muscle cells, turns the key in the lock, sends a signal saying contract. So that's how it causes the contractions of labor. So obviously the more oxytocin there is, the more this effect. But receptor numbers are also dynamic. They can go up and down. So the more receptors there are, the stronger the effect. You could say the more sensitive the body is to that hormone. And you know, if we go back to that idea of laboring in the wild, it's really important that labor is an efficient process, because all the time the mother's in labor, she's at risk of predators, right? So the more efficient her labor, the more likely she and her baby are to survive. So I also say, you know, that labor has evolved to be an efficient process. And one of the things that makes labor efficient is that before the physiologic onset of labor, the natural spontaneous start of labor, there's a dramatic increase in oxytocin receptors, so that the will be sensitive to the oxytocin she releases in labor. And again, if women have been in a situation of being administered Pitocin or being induced with Pitocin, you'll know this, because, you know, some women you can give a little bit of Pitocin and everything happens because they've got this maximal number of receptors. They probably would have gone into labor tomorrow. Some women you can pour bucket loads of Pitocin and nothing happens because they don't have the receptors there. So receptors are really critical, and not only, you know, for initiating labor and making an efficient labor, but the other problem is if you give Pitocin in high dose for a prolonged period, that's a really abnormal way of administering a hormone. The body doesn't produce hormones like that. The body produces hormones in a pulsatile way. It's released from the pituitary gland and pulses in labor, causes arrhythmic contractions of labor. So when we're given this constant high dose, it's kind of a biological principle of hormonal release that the body will protect itself from overexposure, from overstimulation by reducing receptor numbers. So you get receptor downregulation, desensitization. Those are technical terms, but basically what it means is the body reduces its sensitivity to its own oxytocin. So that's the other trouble with Pitocin, and it's, you know, known for sure, it's in all the research, I think it's even on the package insert for Pitocin, that prolonged exposure to high levels, particularly high constant levels of synthetic oxytocin, reduces receptors, reduces sensitivity, and we know for sure that it can increase the risk of postpartum hemorrhage because the woman doesn't have the receptors to respond and get nice strong contractions to stop bleeding after the birth. And probably, you know, it increases the risk of labor petering out, of needing, you know, help with birthing the baby. Again, that's a big oxytocin surge as the baby comes out. So a lot of impacts can happen from exposure to synthetic oxytocin, to Pitocin in labor.
That's interesting, because I've seen women on Pitocin for, you know, 10, 15 hours, if not longer. And then after the baby's born, the routine intervention here is that they get another shot of Pitocin to help the uterus contract. So it doesn't sound like it's ideal that we want them on that long. So I guess it goes way back to what we're saying, is stay at home as long as you can. But if someone does have a very medically justified reason for induction, and you know, they do the prostaglandin to soften the cervix, and then they slowly build the pit, do you feel there's a certain period, after a certain period of time, that the uterus is going to conk out from under stimulation, or as you were talking about, the way the body's receiving the pit? You know, like how long is too long? Or is there a how long?
Well, Yeah, look, because every woman's physiology is different, and particularly when you're talking about induction, because, you know, that's the other thing. Like women, you know, other animals have a much more like certain duration of gestation. Like rats, pretty much every rat goes into labor on day 22. But for women, between 37 and 42 weeks is normal. That's a 5-week span. So, you know, if you're being induced at 39 weeks, you could still be 3 weeks away from your own physiologic labor onset, which means your own maximal responsiveness to all of these hormones, your own maximal number of oxytocin receptors in your uterus, and a whole lot of other preparations that happen before the physiologic onset of labor. And by the way, if you want to know all the technical details, that's in chapter 2 in my report. So yeah, and also talk about the implications for scheduled birth, for pre-labor cesarean, and for induction. So that's the first thing we don't know. We can't judge where a woman is in relation to her physiologic onset of labor. We can get a little bit of an idea by the softness of her cervix, because those cervical changes happen in parallel with all the other changes. But you're right. I mean, certainly there's times when interventions are needed, you know, and the most useful model I find for that is considering that a hormonal gap. Yeah, there's a gap between what is biologically normal, what the body would expect, and what's actually happening. And, you know, sometimes there's good reasons for that, for a pre-labor cesarean, for an in-labor cesarean, for induction. Sometimes it is in the best interests of mother and baby. So how can we, you know, how can we recognize and how can we work inside that hormonal gap? So, you know, obviously the later the onset of, you know, the later we induce, the more likely it is that the mother's ready for labor, that the baby's ready for labor as well, which is why, you know, those new rules have come in, or guidelines have come in saying, you know, don't do these things before 39 weeks unless you've got a really strong reason to do it. And the outcomes are generally better because the mothers have that extra bit of readiness. In terms of labor and birth, you know, if your body's not really primed to do it, you are going to need that hormonal stimulation, and you are going to need that Pitocin afterwards, because you've really interfered with your body's system. So once you start interfering, there is a chance you'll need something to mop up from the interference that you did previously. It's, you know, the cascade of intervention, and there's no way around that. But the other thing that the hormonal gap we haven't really talked about is, you know, we talked about oxytocin being a hormone of motherhood, switching on instinctive mothering behaviors, actually also switching on the reward and pleasure centers in the brain. Beta endorphins do that as well. So that in those moments after birth, the mother's maximally rewarded, maximally pleasured, you know, ecstatic, euphoric when she meets her baby for the first time. And what that does, as my interpretation of this, the science that I've read, is that that imprints pleasure and reward in relation to her baby. So every time she sees her baby, she hears her baby, she smells her baby, she thinks that feels really good. And so, you know, that happens because her brain has also been primed for these critical processes of labor and birth. And, you know, going back to birth in the wild, that instinctive care, the dedicated care that every mammalian mother gives to her newborn is critical for survival. You know, if the mother gave birth successfully, the mother and baby survive, and then the mother walks away, the babies won't survive. So, you know, we're saying in the report that these processes of mother-baby attachment are intertwined and intermingled with the processes, the hormonal processes of labor and birth. So when we interfere with those processes by induction before the woman's had this readiness in her brain, we're going to interfere with that side of things too. And same thing for breastfeeding. There's elaborate preparations that the mother's body makes for breastfeeding that are going to be preempted, that she's going to miss when she's induced. So again, breastfeeding can be a hormonal gap there. So that, you know, in terms of labor and birth, again, private, safe, and unobserved, how can we get the mother's hormonal systems to flow? There's a whole lot of juicy things we can do to release oxytocin, because it is a hormone of sex, it is a hormone of orgasm. Yeah, so those things in labor help to get it flowing, much kinder to the body than Pitocin. You know, privacy is important, as you say, and particularly after the birth, you know, when when there's going to be, again, these hormonal gaps, the more skin-to-skin contact, the more access to breastfeeding, the breast crawl, you may have heard of that. Mm-hmm. All those things will help to switch on the mother's hormonal systems after the birth, switch on the baby's hormonal systems as well. And I just want to share an anecdote, which is a story I read in a birth magazine, actually. And the mother had two previous natural births, and this time the third one had to have a cesarean for medical reasons. And she said, "My instinct after the cesarean was to have my baby skin to skin on me and not let my baby go." And that's exactly what she she did. They call it kangaroo mother care. And she said after 3 days, when my baby came to me, my baby was different. It felt really different to my other babies. And of course it does, because the baby doesn't have the hormonal preparations, the hormonal stimulation of labor and birth, those peaks exactly in parallel to the mother. But she said after 3 days of skin to skin, my baby felt like my other babies. So we can fill in those gaps to some extent, you know, when there are hormonal gaps, but it's a much less efficient process. The body isn't maximally primed for it. It's going to take longer. But the ways to fill in those gaps after the birth is skin to skin and breastfeeding.
Well, that's a great takeaway, because currently in the U.S., about a third of moms are delivering via C-section. So for the listeners out there, if you either know you're having a cesarean or you end up having a cesarean, keep in mind that things hormonally may be different, but the skin to skin and the breastfeeding can really help create that bond and really bring, as you're saying, that gap. Help relieve that gap. So I love that takeaway.
Yeah, and for the baby too, you know, cesarean, I say it's a bit like someone, you know, I think for the experience for the baby, it's a bit like someone coming into your bedroom in the middle of the night and it's really cold and they pull the bed clothes off you and they shine this bright light in your face and you're just not ready to wake up. You haven't been through those whole, you know, sleep time hormonal cycles that have you ready to wake up gently in the morning. So, you know, that's the experience for the baby. They're not prepared for it either. So any ways that we can gently get the, you know, gently soothe the baby into life outside the womb. And there's a whole lot of great things happening. They call it natural cesarean, family-oriented cesarean, gentle cesarean. So if you do need to have a cesarean, look up those things. See, you know, have a talk to your care provider, your OB, and see if you can enact some of those things where the baby's not separated from the mother. In particular, the baby's birthed straight onto the mother's belly. In some situations, the mother actually picks the baby up and brings the baby onto her belly. It's, you know, there's a few things have to happen. The sterile feel, the mother's hands, you know, it's not necessarily a simple process, but I think there's more and more of that happening all around the world, the gentle cesarean. So that's worth looking at. The other, you know, really thing that is really helpful, that actually it's interesting, since I published the report, there've been, you know, some papers, you know, kind of highlighting the things that I discussed in there. And, you know, from a hormonal perspective, I said, you know, the best cesarean is a non-emergent in labor cesarean, where the mother and the baby are ready for labor because labor has been initiated. Then in a leisurely, non-emergency way, the cesarean is done in early labor. And, you know, that there was a paper that came out just a few months ago showing that those babies had better outcomes, and particularly less respiratory breathing difficulties, because that's the big problem for particularly a pre-labor cesarean baby. They haven't had the pre-labor preparations, and then the in-labor processes called the catecholamine surge. The baby gets a surge of adrenaline and noradrenaline that dries out the lungs, that opens up the airways, that prepares the baby for breathing. So that's really why, you know, listeners may realize that cesarean babies are more likely to have breathing difficulties, and the reason is because they don't get this in-labor surge of those hormones called the catecholamine surge. So again, an in-labor non-emergency cesarean is the ideal. Natural cesarean technique if possible, delayed cord clamping if possible. Those are the things that are going to help to close those hormonal gaps, and then early and ongoing skin-to-skin contact with support. Obviously, you know, the mother's been through an operation. She needs someone to help hold the baby. She needs a partner, a midwife. You know, there's a lot of structural changes that needed to shift towards that gentle cesarean, but you know the implications are really, you know, very positive for mothers and babies.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to see that starting to slowly gain some momentum, the gentle cesarean, the natural cesarean. I wanted to talk a little bit about your publication, The Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing. So since it was released last January of 2015, do you feel like it's made an impact in the general practice of obstetrics? Do you feel like, you know, the obstetricians have looked at that and taken that into consideration and maybe even changed some of their practices?
Well, look, I think the thing about the hormonal physiology of childbearing is that it's a different paradigm. We're coming from what we call in the report a salutogenic paradigm. You know, our maternity care system is based on a paradigm of pathology. Like, you know, how can we figure out what, you know, what's wrong, and how can we kind of fix it up or prevent it from happening? Whereas hormonal physiology is a salutogenic paradigm. It's a positive health and well-being paradigm. How can we help things to go well? And that's a little foreign in our maternity care system. So I kind of don't really expect things to change overnight. And the people that have taken it up the most strongly have been those who already subscribe to that paradigm. So midwives, doulas, you know, low technology care providers are, you know, are using it in their work. As far as the obstetricians go, it's a, you know, that's a process really to get it in front of their noses. And that's really why I'm doing a PhD, because I'm writing journal articles to put into hopefully major obstetric journals, so that it kind of gets up there under their noses into the kind of lexicon of obstetrics. So yeah, there's a way to go, but you know, Rome wasn't built overnight, and as I said, it is a new paradigm. So you kind of, you know, you expect that it's not going to suddenly, everyone's going to suddenly take it on. And it, you know, it does have resource implications, because, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, that midwives and doulas are the experts in low technology care. And, you know, especially in a country like America, where, you know, the industry around maternity care, where there's a lot of profits made from maternity care, this is a way of reducing costs. And, you know, it's a for-profit industry, you know, I think.
Well,
so there is some resistance to it.
Worms that you're opening the whole maternal cost and reducing that in
implications. Yeah. And it's not like that in some countries. And in some countries like Australia, we have a public healthcare system where, you know, a cesarean is a negative impact on the healthcare system.
Right.
So, you know, so that they're, you know, and there are more innovative programs happening in Australia. We have some public midwifery schemes. We have some public home birth schemes. You know, some of our government's committed to have midwifery care available to 10% of women. I can't remember by the year, but, you know, there are changes happening. And, you know, some states have published quite revolutionary guidelines. So, you know, there's a little bit more ability to adopt that within a system that where there's some benefit to low technology birth, you know. And that's the difficulty, as we say in America, that the birth is a for-profit industry. So the more technology, the more profits made. And, you know, really, to be honest, you know, all the work that I do is aimed at care providers and providing the science, and that's really important. But look, women, you know, read the stuff, read the science, read the report, and go to my website, sarahbuckley.com, and download an article called Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor. I wrote that for Mothering magazine in 2002, and I'm always updating it. And that really explains a lot of the science. And look, inform yourself and vote with your feet, you know, because it's your body and your baby. And things, from my point of view, have huge implications, like the implication of what we just talked about of switching on the mother's pleasure and reward centers in relation to her baby. Now, that's a really long-term effect, and it's another effect that's going to, you know, sort of have positive feedback. You could say the mother gets pleasure from the baby gets pleasure from the mother. You get into this positive pleasure loop, and that can, you know, that can really sustain you the whole of your parenting career. You know, like I talked to my 25-year-old daughter on the phone the other day, and I just love hearing the sound of her voice. Like, it gives me pleasure, and I'm sure that's because I've had that experience of my pleasure and reward centers being constantly stimulated, even peripherally through the teenage years. You know, there's something to fall back on of the child as rewarding to the parent. And as I said, you know, that's my own interpretation of the data. There was a study that looked at women who'd given birth physiologically without major interventions and women who give given birth by pre-labor cesarean, and they put them into an MRI machine and played them the sound of their baby crying. And when the women had been through a physiologic labor and birth, the reward and pleasure centers lit up even though their baby was crying. You know, they had this imprint of pleasure in relation to their baby that the pre-labor cesarean mothers didn't. You know, there was a hormonal gap there. And as we said, you can fill in that hormonal gap. I'm not saying that you're not going to be a good mother or any of those things if you have a pre-labor cesarean, but I'm saying there's a hormonal gap. Yeah, you're not getting the fullness of that, you know, that easy start, yeah, pleasurable start to mothering. So the more, again, you know, you can fill in that gap, but it's going to take you longer with skin-to-skin contact, with breastfeeding, with carrying your baby, with being in contact with your baby, because all of those things, again, reinforce the hormones that we're talking about.
Well, these are some really great tips. And going back to the feeling safe and undisturbed, that just sets women up, I think, for success if they can do that. And then, of course, finding the care provider they believe in and feel supported by. And then coming into the hospital with the snowball of labor going. These are great tips. I really appreciate you sharing these. And, of course, I'm also very much excited to watch how your publication continues to flourish. And hopefully over time, the more traditional obstetricians will see that and take that in consideration, and that hopefully can change how we approach labor. Do you have?
Yeah, look, I feel positive about it, Deb, because, you know, it's exactly what happened with breastfeeding. There was a time when breastfeeding was seen as some kind of negative, animalistic kind of thing that women did, and then we discovered the huge benefits of breast milk and breastfeeding, and it's really caused a, you know, a renaissance of support for breastfeeding. And I really think we can change things in the same way around physiologic labor and birth. I just want to add one little sentence for the American women, because I know that you have a high use of epidurals, and I want to tell you that epidurals has major impacts on all those hormones. It reduces your oxytocin because it interferes with those positive feedback cycles we were talking about, where the sensation of labor causes a release of oxytocin in the brain. So it reduces the pleasure and reward, it reduces your oxytocin, it makes labor slow down, you need synthetic oxytocin, and then all those things we talked about. So, you know, avoiding an epidural if that's possible, and again, all those things we talked about, care provider, going to hospital late, using your own hormones, is really, you know, is really helpful. And if you do need an epidural, again, there's a hormonal gap, and, you know, and you fill it in as much as possible through contact with your baby afterwards to switch on those hormonal systems that you are inevitably going to miss if you have an epidural.
It's interesting. I actually was just doing some studies on the usage of epidural, the percentage, and I got some 2013 stats for New York City for the 7 major hospitals, and one of them's up to 97% use of epidurals. The average was about 80%. And then I looked at some other statistics. The most recent I found for the U.S. was 2008, and it was about 60% of women take an epidural. Do you know what other countries the rate is? I guess especially with Australia, do you know what the rate of epidural usage is?
Yeah, I haven't looked up the most recent one, but generally in most westernized maternity care systems, the numbers are creeping up, you know, a couple of percent a year. Places like in Australia, we actually have a private and a public system. So within the public system that I mentioned before, where it's a not-for-profit, the epidural rates are a little lower, maybe about 20%. In the private system, one-third of women give birth in a system a lot like the US, and the epidural rates are much higher, like 40 to 50%, and higher again in first-time mothers. And England has similar figures to our public system. Again, I think it's, I'm just ballpark figure, 20 to 25%. Even in a country like the Netherlands, which has a solid and structural support for physiologic childbirth, their epidural rates are increasing. I think they're over 20% now. And that's generally, you know, kind of the way it is in most parts of the world. But America has much more extreme epidural figures. 70% is kind of a rule of thumb. That's from the Listening to Mothers reports. And, you know, I think the problem is, you know, there's not a lot of other options offered to women. It's very much a for-profit system, and women talk about how they're kind of pressured into having an epidural, even though they're going to hospital not wanting one. And again, just going back to everything we've said before, if you want to labor with your own hormonal physiology and not disrupt it with an epidural, then, you know, choose your model of care, take a doula with you, go into hospital late, all of those things.
Nitrous oxide is slowly creeping in. There's one hospital here in New York City that has it for the birth center in downtown, and there's another actually midwifery practice starting that will be having nitrous oxide. So I'd be curious to see if that can shift the epidural rate.
Yes, well, when I did the report initially, we had a much wider list of interventions to look at, and nitrous oxide was on the list, but we really couldn't find any material about the relationship between nitrous oxide and hormonal physiology and, you know, and any impact on the hormonal system. So we had to take that out. It is an intervention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can say we don't think it has major impacts because it has a short half-life. It's out of the body quite quickly.
Right.
It does displace oxygen within the blood. So that's why you can't use too high levels of it. That's why there's a kind of cap, you know, there's a valve system. So you can't suck too much of it. You know, you just use it when you need it during a contraction, and then it goes from the body between contractions. So that's a benefit as well. It is a much lower impact kind of analgesia. But, you know, there were some studies, there's a couple of studies have been done looking at long-term impacts of drugs in labor. And I don't want to scare anyone with this, but one was from Scandinavia and it was repeated in the US using a US data set, retrospective studies, comparing babies or children who were born with their siblings and then looking at risk of adult addiction. And there was an increased risk for prolonged use of nitrous oxide in labor. So the thing is, you know, that the baby, and again, we're going back to some basic biology, or as we understand now, is epigenetics, you know, the ability of gene expression, genes to get turned on and off. And, you know, we understand that this is a really significant phenomenon, and birth is really an epigenetic phenomenon. Our genes are getting turned on and off all over the place for the baby to, you know, adapt from, you know, life in the womb to life outside the womb, from, you know, oxygen through the blood to oxygen through the lungs. I mean, so many changes happening. So, you know, we really the bottom line should be any drugs, anything non-physiological that we do at that time could have, you know, effects in the longer term. So, you know, you want to choose the lowest impact thing. And if you do need pain relief, nitrous oxide is certainly lower impact than an epidural or probably than opioids, you know, meperidine. But we can't say that any of them have no impact on the longer term because we just don't know. We haven't looked. And again, if you want to know more about my thoughts on this, read chapter one in my report.
Well, that is a perfect segue. Do you have any last minute tips for our listeners?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the things that we talked about really reflect the kind of culture of maternity care that we have right now. And it's not just about the hospitals and the care providers, but the kind of pathology-based model, you know, perspective, as opposed to low technology, kind of salutogenic, positive, how can we promote a healthy labor and birth. But that's also in our culture, and we touched a bit on this with fear. So, you know, not just choosing a health, you know, a low technology care provider, but also, you know, what can you do for yourself in pregnancy to really, you know, you could say protect your brain, protect your ideas around birth, because, you know, unfortunately, one of the first things that happens when you get pregnant is people tell you awful stories, and you've got to find a way of not having those impact your experience and shutting yourself off to those, you know, saying thanks but no thanks, you know, because you really, you know, you're very vulnerable and you're very, you could say, open, you know, got all these hormones beginning to act in pregnancy that make you more soft and tender, that make you more trusting with oxytocin. So you really do need to protect your well-being and find, you know, this is what Peggy O'Mara for Mothering Magazine says, find, you know, a healthy birth subculture, find a play group, find a meeting place, you know, that home birth, yoga class, exactly, you know, where you can meet with people that are aligned and that will give you positive birth stories. And, you know, the other great thing that's happened in the last decades is a lot of great videos on birth. So, you know, those are powerful, the images that you can take in of women giving birth, of the noises, you know, like a birth as realistic, not the kind of, you know, not the sort of fluffy sweet version. I mean, birth is a raw process, right? It's challenging, it's primal, it's animalistic, you know, you do go to those parts of yourself. So it's not sweet and fluffy things you sometimes see on YouTube, but, you know, those images of a woman in her own raw power giving birth are really positive ones to absorb when you're pregnant as well. So, you know, looking after your mind in pregnancy.
Yeah, I think we need to erase some of the movie impact of the woman screaming and helpless and take that away and go more to the foundation that women's bodies can do this. I think that's what a lot of people take into them when they think of birth.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And unfortunately, you know, as you say, that's in our culture generally. So how can you positively brainwash yourself, you know, because I mean, birth is the ultimate expression of women's power. It's the most powerful thing that anyone can do to grow a new life, to produce new life. I mean, and when you have that full hormonal experience of labor and birth, you come out of it thinking, if I can do this, I can do anything. And that's what you need to look after your baby. And it has ripples through your whole life. You know, it's the most empowering, positive. There's no superlatives to describe that feeling. And for many of us, you know, probably you and me, you know, many people that work in this area, that's why we do what we do, because I had this amazing experience and I want other women, other families to have it, you know.
Well, I think it also affects how we share our birth with our children. You know, I was really fortunate, and some of my listeners have heard that I had a really positive birth experience that I heard of. My mom never talked about the fear. It was quick. She felt powerful during it. And so I grew up hearing this story and just thinking that birth was very possible and very, you know, open and available, where others, I feel, if they had a traumatic birth, the mom is going to, whether she means to or not, pass down this trauma. And then the child's going to then have that as their image. So the more that we can help women have a powerful, empowered experience, I think it goes to generation to generation. That's one thing that fires me up, is knowing that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and from, you know, like, translating that biologically, you know, I could say that when all those mechanisms get switched on in birth, then we parent in a particular way. You know, we sort of naturally do what we might loosely be called attachment parenting, because because you know, those protective systems are turned on, those reward and pleasure systems are turned on, and we won't. I remember with my first baby, like I had this mental idea I was going to have a nursery and my baby was going to be in a crib, and but once I gave birth, like I didn't want my baby more than a meter away, which is, you know, my biology kicking in, that fierce protective defense of maternal behaviors, and then the reward and pleasure kicking in. So, you know, in animal studies, all of those things, when the offspring get high levels of maternal care, they go on to give higher levels of maternal care, and that's an epigenetic effect related to the oxytocin system. So there's certainly, you know, biological models for the way that birth and particularly the relationship to early mothering can get passed on down the generations.
This is great information. I'm so thrilled. Can you tell our listeners more about where they can find you, your social media, your online courses, your website, your books? There's so much.
Yeah. So, if you want all the kind of hormonal detail, then go to childbirthconnection.org and download the report. There's also some resources there for women. There's a beautiful book about the hormones of labor that's also translated into Spanish. There's an infographic on the pathway to a healthy birth and also for care providers. So that's kind of all the juicy science. So that report has like more than 1,100 scientific references. So it's very grounded in the kind of things I've been saying. I also recommend you go to my website, sarahbuckley.com, and go to my subscription and download that free ebook called Ecstatic Birth Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labor. So it's a sort of short version of what I'm saying. It doesn't have all the detail of the report. There's also, and then you get onto my professionals mail list. There's also an ebook called Pain and Labor, Your Hormones Are Your Helpers, which is a very simple version of this. And again, you get onto my parents list there. If you want to know more of my interpretation of all of that, kind of not so technically detailed, I have a membership website called gentlenaturalbirth.com. At the moment I have an early pregnancy program that goes into a lot of details. There's a great section there about choosing your maternity care provider, very salient to what we talked about. There's two videos talking about how to make wise decisions, how to, you know, weigh up all the pros and cons using a model, the brain model. And also, if you want, again, you want more information, there's my professionals, Gentle Natural Birth membership, which has, you know, a whole lecture on the hormonal physiology, the ecstatic hormones of labor and birth. It has a whole lecture on the impacts of interventions, which we've touched upon. It has lectures on the hour after birth, on things like group B strep, on things like cord clamping, cord blood banking, a whole lot of really great evidence-based information there as well.
Wow. So people can find you and continue to learn from you. So I just wanted to thank you for your time and for helping me arrange this, because I know I had a really hard time figuring out between Brisbane and New York City. So
time zones, yeah.
Yeah, that was a little challenging. And I just wanted to again thank you for your time, your effort, the work you do, because it's so important for our women and for birth and for the babies. So I will let you know when this comes out, and I just I'm so happy I've had a chance to chat with you. So I'm going to say good night. And listeners, if you liked this, please go to iTunes or Stitcher and rate and review. And please take your time and check out Dr. Sarah Buckley's information on her website and all her online stuff, because she's really wonderful. All right. I guess it's time to bid adieu. Have a wonderful night and thank you. Or it's morning for you.
My pleasure, Dave. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.